This program is paid for by Your Radio Doctor, LLC. All opinions or statements expressed on this program are solely those of Your Radio Doctor and their guests and do not reflect the opinions of WPHT or Odyssey. Your Radio Doctor does not recommend or endorse any specific tests, products, physicians, procedures, opinions, or other information that may be mentioned on Your Radio Doctor. Always consult your own physician. Today's program has been pre-recorded.
At Independence Blue Cross, we take care of the people who take care of you. Everyday heroes like firefighters, police officers, teachers, farmers, and healthcare workers. Doctors and hospitals across the region have IBX, and they know what it means to have reliable access to care. So whether you're saving lives or just trying to live a healthier life, count on IBX, the region's number one health insurer for 85 years. Learn more at IBX.com.
Talk Radio 1210, WPHT, WPHT, HD, WOGL, HD3, Philadelphia. From the Cherry Hill Volvo Studios, where relationships matter. Always live on the free Odyssey app. It's time for the Delaware Valley's first radio doctor.
On call every Saturday afternoon at 5.
This is Your Radio Doctor with Dr. Marianne Ritchie. Presented exclusively by Independence Blue Cross.
Listen, 7 months or 10 months is an absolutely exceptionally short time frame to produce this vaccine.
Your health determines your life, your longevity, and your happiness. Let your radio doctor lead the way with your medical education. Your radio doctor, Dr. Marianne Ritchie.
Good afternoon and welcome to Your Radio Doctor. I'm your host, Dr. Marianne Ritchie. Well, more than 4 years have passed since COVID-19 came to town, but it looks like at least some version of it is here to stay. Here with an update is our friend Dr. Paul Offit, Director of the Vaccine Education Center, Professor of Pediatrics, and the Maurice Hilleman Professor of Vaccinology at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. He's an international expert in the fields of virology and immunology. He's a member of the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices to the CDC, also a member of the FDA Vaccines Advisory Committee. What's really cool, and it took many years, Paul, 27, am I right? He's the co-inventor of the vaccine for rotavirus recommended by the CDC for universal use in our infants. He's been awarded unbelievable awards from the University of Penn, national societies, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, as well as international societies, foundations, universities, it goes on. And in the spring, he published a book called Tell Me When It's Over, which is a must-read for everyone because it really looks at the pandemic from the very beginning and as it progressed, and it's educating your educated guests as to where it's going to go. Welcome, Paul.
Thank you, Marianne. It's my pleasure.
It's our pleasure to have you, really, because you are just a wealth of information. And there's a current strain of COVID that seems to be popping up here and there. How is it different from former strains?
Well, so we're still in the Omicron era. So the virus that first came into this country was the first variant, really. It was a variant of the original Wuhan 1 strain or ancestral strain. And it didn't have a Greek letter designation. It was called D614G. But in 2020 and then 2021, it was replaced by the Alpha variant, then the Delta variant, then at the end of 2021, the Omicron variant. And so everything you've seen since then, since the end of 2021, throughout 2022, 2023, and now 2024, are all sort of evolutions of that original Omicron variant. I'm still waiting for an article that's called Where is Pi? Because, you know, when do we get to that next Greek letter? So the XEC variant, which was circulating in Europe, now has clearly entered the United States and may well become the dominant variant by the winter, is a variant that comes from this, you know, the Omicron strain. So it's different because this virus continues to evolve. I mean, all viruses mutate, but this virus mutates more than typical. And so it's always trying to evade the recognition by our antibodies, which makes it easier then for the virus to attach to cells.
Well, Mother Nature was really clever with this one, because from what I'm reading, if I'm right, it's a combination of two variants. Now, how could that happen? Could that be that one person was infected with COVID and ate another bad apple and had a second variant, and then they combined in that person, and then he coughed at a party? I mean, how does that happen and get transmitted?
No, the first of all, reassortants occur in nature all the time. And you're right, this is a reassortant virus, I think, between KP1 and KP3. So you have this strain. That happens all the time. I mean, the rotavirus vaccine that we made is really a reassortant virus between a bovine strain, which has weakened virulence characteristics in people, and human strain. So you can get the best of both worlds, which is an immune response without having to pay the price of natural infection. Mm-hmm. So yeah, reassortant events occur all the time.
Well, this one's called XEC. Am I right? And does that stand for extra ooey COVID? I don't know, but it is highly contagious. But the good news is the symptoms are the same, so pretty easy to recognize, but less severe than other strains. So you could say, oh, isn't Omicron so cute? It's not as nasty as Alpha or Delta. But in your mind, it's probably because, 98% of the population is finally reaching that herd immunity. Herd immunity is a lower number, but you're happy that people have retained some immunity. Do you think that's why the symptoms are a little kinder?
Right. Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, there's a very high level of population immunity. Most people have been vaccinated or naturally infected or both. And although we always focus on antibodies, because antibodies are important in preventing the virus from binding to cells, there is a second line of defense in the immune system that's caused by something called T cells. And what those cells do is they kill virus-infected cells before the virus has a chance to reproduce itself. And it happens very quickly. It happens within an hour of the virus entering the cell. The cell's killed, so the virus doesn't get to reproduce itself. And I think that's really at the heart of what's continuing to prevent us from having serious infections, because the rate of hospitalizations is clearly down. The rate of deaths is clearly down. And I think that's largely because of these T cells. There's a Harvard immunologist named Dan Baruch who calls T cells the unsung hero of this pandemic. And I think that's exactly right.
So for our listeners, just a brief review. Red blood cells carry oxygen. White cells are the soldiers that fight off infection. And there are two of the types are B cells that make antibodies that are the little soldiers that say, hey, virus, you're not going to rest your laurels here. They prevent the virus from the landing on the cell and entering and doing its thing. T cells, as you say, kill the infected cell directly, so the show's over. And they seem to last longer. That's what's in our system for years and years. And as you say, they don't get enough credit. So we'll talk about what that means in terms of boosters and vaccines and all that good stuff. But so going back, the symptoms are the same recognizable song. Cough and congestion, runny nose, mild headache, maybe loss of appetite. Some people get diarrhea. Some people get chills without the fever. Occasional loss of taste or smell, but it's important because personally, I never had COVID until 2 weeks ago. I don't know how or why, because I was back in practice, people coughing and all that good stuff. And somehow my immune system was either asleep or very awake, but I didn't get COVID. And a couple weeks ago, I was a little chilly one day and an extra sweater didn't help. And then I had a headache. I'm like, oh man. And sure enough, and I it was very mild, and within a couple of days I was fine. I just stayed home for 6 days, an extra day for good measure, and voila. And boy, was that humbling to think other people who got the bug are gone. So that's a lesson in gratitude, yes?
Yeah, I think that at the beginning, in 2020, when you know, the Alpha variant and the Delta variant were king. Most people hadn't been naturally infected. And in 2020, no one had been vaccinated. So when you would see the virus come in, you would have a high level of infection and a high level of serious infection. And that's what happened. You would see the Alpha variant would cause a high level of hospitalization. Then the Delta would come in high level of hospitalization. By the time Omicron came in at the end of 2021, you now had the vaccine available for a year. And you'd also had a lot of natural infection. So there was a variance between sort of the height of infection, mild infection, and severe disease. I mean, the virus clearly swept across the country, but it didn't have the same level of serious illness and hospitalization, and that's because there was a high level of population immunity. So when you look at the XEC variant, there's a very high level of population immunity. So there'll be, it sort of will sweep across, and people will develop mild infections, but unlikely to develop severe infections in the same way that we did at the beginning.
Mm-hmm. And we had a nice chat the other day to talk about what we wanted to emphasize in the show, and I remember saying, I've heard patients say, or even people, I can trace my exposure back to, we happened to be on a nice tour, my husband and I, about a week before I got sick. And the tour guide said, we're all going to be on this bus, and anybody who develops sniffles or test yourself, whatever, but sit at the back and wear a mask. So a couple of people were sick, and the day I was coming home, I started to become symptomatic, and I realized we were all out to dinner one night, and I was sitting next to a woman who next day had a mask. And we're going to talk about when the virus is most contagious. It's before you have symptoms, yes?
Yes, exactly. There's two phases of illness. The first phase is the phase where the virus reproduces itself. And then as you develop your immune response, when you make antibodies to kill to not allow the virus to attach to cells, or you develop T cells which kill virus-infected cells, that's when you develop your symptoms. It's the immune response that causes symptoms. So as your immune response starts to increase, the virus reproduction starts to go down, and then you have, you know, your symptoms, and then the symptoms come down later. So you're right, you're most contagious a day or two before you develop any symptoms. Mm-hmm. That's what makes this virus, that makes these kind of viruses so hard to deal with. And in 2020, when we didn't have anything, when we didn't have antivirals and we didn't have monoclonals and we didn't have vaccines, all we had was trying to prevent human-to-human contact, knowing that people who were completely asymptomatic could be shedding the virus. See, that's not true for something like smallpox. Usually smallpox, everybody's symptomatic. So you know who's sick, you know, and makes it a little easier.
True. We always forget that there are some people who float through without any symptoms. So you wouldn't realize that person may have been in contact. So when people ask, how do I know I have COVID, or that it's not just an allergic reaction, I'm sneezing because I'm out and it's pollen time or whatever, or a cold? And you say,
test yourself. If you have respiratory congestion, cough, runny nose, achiness, et cetera, if you have those kinds of symptoms, and you, especially if you're in a high-risk group, the kind of person who could develop severe disease, like someone who's pregnant or immune compromised, who has chronic lung or heart disease or obesity or diabetes, test yourself. And if you're positive and you can take an antiviral. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's even with this, my own case, I'm just trying to, you know, give people a picture of this. I knew there were a couple of people in this group who were positive, and I've had a few colds in the past 4.5 years. I have grandchildren who snuggle with me and all that good stuff, and I always test negative, although I guess there can be false negatives. But this was different. This, I had this nagging headache that I couldn't put my finger on, and the chills without fever. This is definitely different than anything I've had, you know, in the past since, you know, that came to town in March of 2020. So the current vaccine, Paul, we have a few minutes in this segment. We can carry it into the next. The 2024-2025 updated COVID vaccine, that will protect against XEC, the current strain that's in town?
Yes. As you know, first of all, there's two vaccines. There's two classes of vaccines this year. There's Novavax, which is a purified protein vaccine, and that's directed against the JN1 strain. The JN1 strain begat the sort of KP1, KP2, KP3 strains. And then this XEC strain is a reassortment between, I think, KP1 and KP3. So they're all very similar. And the mRNA vaccines is actually a KP2 strain. So I think that all of these have a high degree of cross-reactivity. And I think that for those who are at high risk, it's certainly of value to get a yearly vaccine.
Mm-hmm. So what you're saying is the current XEC strain is the grandchild of the original Wuhan strain. That, I mean, when you look back and your book talks about this, you were able to sequence that virus. And that's not just some little thing that you line a virus up under the microscope and see its makeup. That's a very detailed, you were able to do it quickly and with new technology, create a vaccine that worked. And we're going to talk about more about that later. But so people should rest assured they get the vaccine now. It's kind of like what you do when you look ahead for the flu vaccines. In March, you can guesstimate what flu will be coming to town in September, October, based on what you're seeing in South America, in the Southern Hemisphere, because their winters and our summers are opposite. So each March, you get together and design a vaccine for the Northern Hemisphere. And then next week, you'll be planning in South America for their next flu, which will be in our spring, but it'll be their winter.
Right. We're actually meeting on Thursday to discuss it for the Southern Hemisphere. Right.
Where, I guess it's by Zoom, or are you going to South America?
Not Zoom. It's no, we pick for South America. We pick them here. No, we used to always meet at, you know, in suburban DC, but not now.
Oh, but we tried. Let's take a little break and more on Your Radio Doctor when we come back with our friend Dr. Paul Offit.
Thanks for listening to Your Radio Doctor with Dr. Marianne Ritchie, exclusively presented by Independence Blue Cross. If you have a question for the medical mailbag, just send a note to doctor@yourradiodoctor.net.
At Independence Blue Cross, we take care of the people who take care of you. Everyday heroes like firefighters, police officers, teachers, farmers, and healthcare workers. Doctors and hospitals across the region have IBX, and they know what it means to have reliable access to care. So whether you're saving lives or just trying to live a healthier life, count on IBX, the region's number one health insurer for 85 years. Learn more at IBX.com.
Welcome back to Your Radio Doctor. We're so fortunate to have our friend Dr. Paul Offit here with an update on COVID. And we're learning that the current strain is called XEC, which is the grandchild of the original virus that came to town. But the cool thing about that is we know that the vaccine that's available to us right now has information from the preceding two generations, and it should protect us from the surge that will probably happen in the wintertime. We saw a little bump in the summer. Didn't that start maybe in Germany and June of this year, it spread rapidly through Europe. Is that the same bug, that the strain that we're getting, XEC? So that said, the word surge comes up, Paul, and that's what was so overwhelming that had us all in Gotham City shaking in our boots. Was the world going to end because people were so sick? Hospitals were hemorrhaging, trying to take care of all the people as outpatients and inpatients. Why is surge control so important?
Well, you have a limited amount of hospital capacity. I don't think I would have ever imagined that was true until now, when in 2020, we were overwhelmed with this virus. I mean, I work at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, which is a children's hospital. So, you know, children less than 18, certainly far less likely to be hospitalized if they were infected with this virus than people, say, over 65. But we had three floors of patients with COVID. Our ICU was overflowing. You had trouble taking care of those patients as well as all the other patients we need to take care of. We had to cancel elective surgeries. People were working double shifts. We didn't have, you know, frankly, the masks that we needed. We didn't have the gowns that we needed. People were wearing bandanas instead of masks. They were wearing sort of garbage bags instead of gowns. And it was just a nightmare. It was like being in a MASH unit. And so you know, people, certainly other hospitals were trying to lay people off to let them go to even different hospitals. And that shows you, the big phrase at the time was flatten the curve,
right?
Flatten the curve, because we were just overwhelmed with this virus.
And there was just an article in the Annals of Internal Medicine. Not that too many of our listeners read that, but it was a real look back at the past, common sense. The lead author was Dr. Manoraj Nupain. He's an MD, PhD at the NIH. And he said, basically, the four S's, stuff, staff, systems, the type of hospital, and I guess the size, I forget the fourth S, but the point being, one in five people died from COVID. And it was, as you say, if you look at the whole chessboard, he studied all this, the data, he and his colleagues, and it wasn't a matter of the type of hospital. Are you going to do better in an academic hospital because we have maybe more equipment or something like that? He looked at small community hospitals, academic, all types of hospitals, and the rate limiting step was just volume. And that in the future, maybe we'll have a strategy that helps to redistribute patients in a certain area, that if one hospital is really overloaded, that some of the less sickly patients might be moved to a different hospital and try to keep decompressing so that suffocation kind of situation doesn't happen again. So, Paul, the current treatments that are available, you mentioned Paxlovid. Let's talk about that.
Right. So Paxlovid is an antiviral drug. In order for it to work, it needs to be given early in infection when virus replication is the critical part of the disease process. Once the virus replication reproduction starts to come down, it's going to be much less effective. So the earlier, the better. There are many drug-drug interactions with Paxlovid, so you need to make sure you talk with your doctor about whether you are taking a drug that that may interfere. And it may be that it's still better to take Paxlovid because you can afford to stop that other drug for a day or two or three or four or five. So you need to talk to your doctor about that. And then the other two antivirals, remdesivir and molnupiravir, are sort of second and third line agents, but they are also available for those who can't take Paxlovid. But it is galling, actually, or hard to watch, that there are still people who die in the hospital because they didn't take Paxlovid early. So yeah, this is a treatment that is in many ways underutilized.
So the antiviral for flu is called Tamiflu. That you really have to take within 48 hours of symptoms, yes?
Right, and doesn't have really the impact, or the data aren't as compelling, frankly, with Tamiflu as they are with Paxlovid. So you'll save about a day of symptoms.
Well, I bring that up because the beauty of Paxlovid is you really do have 5 days. Obviously, if there are 100 viruses floating in your system, it's a lot easier to grab those guys than the 10,000 or 100,000 or whatever it multiplies to. So always the earlier the better. But don't take your brother's pill. Don't take, I don't know if you could get that off the internet, but basically you need a prescription for it, and hopefully you would talk to your doctor. Hopefully your doctor would look at your list of meds. But the ones that stand out in my mind, just from patients of mine, are if you're on a statin drug that helps to control your cholesterol levels, you can probably live without that for the 5 days you're on Paxlovid. But if you're on a blood thinner like Eliquis, no. Do not put that pill anywhere near yourself till you check with your doctor. So that's and you can look up online. It's all kinds of meds that Paxlovid may interfere with: hypertensive therapies, antipsychotics, migraine headaches. So please make sure, we always say that, just like taking supplements from a health food store, always check with your doc. So as you say, Paul, two phases. The virus comes in, replicates, but you don't feel the repercussions until your immune system answers the call. And then that's when you become symptomatic. So remember, if you've been exposed or you think that you've been exposed, be so careful for a day or two before you get symptoms. That's when you hurt other people. So that Paxlovid is recommended rather than no therapy. You really want to get that bug under control for people 65 and older, regardless of their vaccination history. Those who are immunocompromised, of course, with or without a vaccine in their past. And then immunocompetent people, people that don't have any major illnesses like diabetes, heart or lung disease, that haven't had a vaccine, right? Or immunocompetent people, they're not immunocompromised, but they do have severe diseases like heart, lung, kidney, yes? Are they the categories you'd really impress?
Yeah, and pregnant people. Those are the groups, yes.
And pregnant. Why is it that COVID is nastier in pregnant people, or riskier, I should say?
It's interesting. If you look at pregnant people who are infected with COVID, they are 2.5 to 3 times more likely to be admitted to the intensive care unit and die than people who are not pregnant who have COVID. So of the same age, women of the same age. And it's interesting. That's also true for pertussis, which is a greater threat to the mom. It's also true for influenza. Interestingly, it's not true for respiratory syncytial virus or RSV. I have no idea why that's true. You would think they would all be a greater risk to the pregnant person, but for RSV, mm-hmm. No.
And if a pregnant mom contracts COVID, what about the baby? Is it more likely to lead to a premature delivery? Can the baby contract it? I guess.
Yes, mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's not really transplacentally, but it is a risk for premature birth. That's mm-hmm, certainly. Mm-hmm.
But I know really young infants don't have the receptors on their cells that the virus likes to attach to. So that's why most of the time babies are a little bit safer, and you start with a 6-month recommendation for the vaccine. So people were talking about the rebound that people get when they take Paxlovid, which you're saying it's not. We've already talked about it earlier. What happens if a person takes Paxlovid, they start to feel better, and then their symptoms return? How do we explain that?
Well, so what happens is So two phases of illness. There's the first phase, which where the virus reproduces itself, and then the immune response comes up. So you're trying to take that the symptoms, when the symptoms are the most mild at the beginning, to take Paxlovid and then for 5 days. Well, now you're moving into the second phase of illness, when the immune response gets more and more robust and you get more and more symptoms. So people would think, okay, well, I stopped the Paxlovid and now my symptoms are worse. This is Paxlovid rebound. But there really is that's really not a thing. When people have done the right kinds of studies to see whether there's any difference in the level of symptoms for people who did or didn't take Paxlovid, you know, whatever, 5, 6, 7, 8 days after the illness started, there's really no difference. So it's unfortunate because it's just a phrase that continues to stick with us, even though it's not a real thing.
Yeah. So if a person takes Paxlovid early on and they seem to level off and then they stop the medication and their symptoms seem to increase again, not to worry, you can test again. But that's the other thing. If you've taken the medication and you start to feel better, I know I had a dental appointment that I canceled, and it was day 6, but I thought I'd better give it a little extra time. But I called and I said, can I reschedule? And they said, yes, after your test is negative. But you can have COVID and all symptoms clear. How long might your test remain positive if you retest yourself?
Well, so the antigen test can be positive for 5, 6, 7 days, continue to be positive. I think probably the most, and we're driving ourselves crazy with this, with the PCR test, the genetic test, it can be weeks. So that's the good news about the genetic test, the PCR test, polymerase chain reaction test, is it was very sensitive. But the bad news is it was very sensitive. So it could, you know, not be a good predictor of whether you were still contagious. I think from your first real symptoms, if you can, should sort of stay away or stay home if you can for at least 5 days before you go out. It's probably a good rule of thumb. Mm-hmm.
So what's the test people are most likely to buy at their local pharmacy? The antigen. Test. So antigen, for our listeners, means it tests for the presence of the virus itself.
The virus proteins, not the virus.
Yeah, we don't want the virus sitting in a box in the supermarket or the pharmacy. So we talked about the contraindication to Paxlovid. Is there, are the same contraindications applied to molnupiravir or remdesivir?
No, the level of drug-drug interactions between either remdesivir or molnupiravir is much less, and they are backups. They're not, the remdesivir is an intravenous drug, so that makes it more difficult, and molnupiravir is not quite as effective as Paxlovid, but it is to some extent effective, and it's better to take something that's to some extent effective than to take nothing at all.
And so they're both oral preparations, right?
Well, molnupiravir is. Remdesivir, I think,
is still IV. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so the infusions that were available at the very beginning with the, why can't I think of the expression? That's not available now?
Well, so the first antiviral drug was remdesivir. That was the first one that was tested. Unfortunately, it was tested in hospitalized patients. So by that time, you're already well into the second phase. So the drug wasn't going to look as good as if you had used it early in the illness when you were still in the first phase. But remdesivir was really the first drug that was available.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I remember that. But I was thinking convalescent plasma. About 30 seconds.
No, you're right. This convalescent plasma was probably underused, actually.
How would you explain that to people, what that was and how it worked?
It was antibodies. It was antibodies directed against the virus. So the vaccine causes you to make antibodies, but here you're just cheating. You're skipping a step. You're just giving the person the antibodies. And early in illness is clearly a value.
And they were retrieved how?
But from people who were infected with the virus.
Right. So we got them from people who were zombied from the COVID. But they're not available now, correct?
No, I still think convalescent sera is available. I still think it's available. It's probably hard to get, but it is out there.
Yeah. I was just wondering because I know a couple of patients have asked me about it. And as you say, the need for that is much lesser because we have the Paxlovid and remdesivir. So that's a great summary. Thank you, Paul. Let's take a little break. And when we come back, more about COVID and its update. And now for your real champion, I call this segment Figure Skating with a Vision. One of my fondest childhood memories is going to the Ice Capades, front row seats to Wonderland.
beautiful ballerinas gliding on the ice, arm in arm with their handsome princes. It was pure magic. And when you think about it, figure skating really does encompass dance and gymnastics, moving in time to enchanting music and drifting snowflakes. Well, I can say from experience, it's a whole lot harder than it looks. The last time I went ice skating, our daughter was 7 years old. She was so excited to show me how she could skate on 1 foot at a time. Now you try it, Mommy. Well, by a bold spur-of-the-moment reflex, I skated left, right, left, and boom. It was not a soft landing, and within minutes I felt a gnawing pain in my arm because I broke my elbow. My admiration for figure skaters instantly skyrocketed. Well, recently I had the good fortune to meet Mr. Stash Serafin, a master of figure skating, and if you watch his YouTube videos, you'll be amazed by his skill and grace. But what's particularly impressive about his flawless performance is that he's blind. Yes, this is a man who skates as easily as he walks, and he does so in complete darkness. Stash was born prematurely in 1953. At the time, babies who came early were placed in incubators with highly concentrated oxygen. The intense therapy caused retinal damage and subsequent blindness in many of those infants. Well, when he was a little boy, his mother would tell him to walk in circles, and she would rattle acorns in her pocket and say, "Catch me if you can." She was intuitive because she helped him feel and learn how to take cues from sensation. It developed his sense of self-awareness, and with her help, it amplified all of his other senses. Well, Stash always had a sixth sense. When he played with his younger brother and cousins, he moved about unencumbered, unobstructed, especially with music. He said it was like liquid. He climbed trees, he ran in the yard, he even caught lightning bugs. He said he could feel them and smell them in the jar. He attended grade school at the Overbrook School for the Blind, and his world opened up with the help of great teachers, Braille, and the opportunity to live and learn with other students who were visually impaired. The structured program made for a safe and productive educational environment, but part of Stash longed for that freedom to roam, which he had at home. He tried roller skating a few times, but that didn't fill the void, and the liquid went away. When he was 16, a family friend brought him to the Melody Brook Ice Skating Rink in Colmar, Pennsylvania, a place that was open to the public, but also drew those who wanted to train. Peggy Fleming had graced the ice just a month before. Everyone was amazed that Stash could keep his balance. So the next day he went back, and the owner gave him a pair of skates to begin training. He was the first blind skater to ever visit their rink. The teacher said, "Listen to what I'm doing." And soon after, Stash was able to move with grace. Stash left the blind school after 8th grade to mainstream at Wissahickon High School and is very grateful for the school district who provided special teachers who helped him translate his work into Braille and offered books on tape at a time very early in technology. He has fond memories of his many friends, attending his proms, and the surprise when his classmates dedicated the class of 1973 yearbook to him. One of his YouTube videos opens with Stash tying his skates. Once he hears the music, he leaves any nervous feelings in the locker room and enters the ice with no fear. And by age 20, he was able to jump, double axel, and spin, even sit spin. He was a regular in skating shows with stars like Dorothy Hamill, Scott Hamilton, Brian Boitano, even Elvis Stoiko. He went on to teach figure skating to both visually impaired and sighted students. He was unstoppable, skating by sound and intuition. He even took the optional dance and freestyle skating tests, judged by the U.S. Figure Skating Association, the first blind person to ever try, and passed several of the tests on the first try. Stash becomes liquid on the ice, where he has the chance to say something as he moves to the music. Everything he learned about movement is a great asset in his professional work as a therapist, especially when he's administering massage therapy. He knows the value of feeling. You don't just look at a dream, you step into it. He makes beautiful pottery and says clay is very forgiving. You can make it into anything you want, but you have to feel it. And at age 71, he is still feeling when he's ice skating. He also coaches people in sensitivity skills and believes love expands, fear squashes. In the end, love is the only thing that really matters. Stash Serafin, a man of resilience, a man with a positive attitude that's palpable. He lives a life without sight, but he certainly has a vision. We salute you, Stash Serafin. You're a real champion.
Today's edition of Your Radio Doctor with Dr. Marianne Ritchie, presented exclusively by Independence Blue Cross, can be enjoyed anytime, anywhere, at your convenience. Just download the Odyssey app and search Your Radio Doctor. It's health education on demand.
At Independence Blue Cross, we take care of the people who take care of you. Everyday heroes like firefighters, police officers, teachers, farmers, and healthcare workers. Doctors and hospitals across the region have IBX, and they know what it means to have reliable access to care. So whether you're saving lives or just trying to live a healthier life, count on IBX, the region's number one health insurer for 85 years. Learn more at IBX.com.
Your Radio Doctor, Dr. Marianne Ritchie, now Saturday afternoons at 5, presented exclusively by Independence Blue Cross.
This program is paid for by Your Radio Doctor, LLC.
Welcome back to Your Radio Doctor. Dr. Paul Offit, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. You explain things so clearly and logically, and people seem a little bit less nervous than they were, obviously, when COVID really started to disrupt our whole culture and our way of life. And some of the changes in life, like hybrid working, etc., have stayed with us. But I worry a little bit, I'm sure you do as well, that people are looking at their respiratory infections and saying, well, it's not COVID. What the heck, you know? I tested negative so I could still go out and infect other people. Well, guess what? People die of the flu. People die from RSV. Let's talk about that for a minute.
Right. So every year, there are hundreds of thousands of people who are hospitalized with influenza and anywhere from 20 to 60,000 who die every year from influenza. A respiratory syncytial virus causes hundreds of thousands of children to be hospitalized and about a few hundred to die. And it causes hundreds of thousands of adults to be hospitalized and anywhere from 10 to 14,000 to die. Viruses like parainfluenza virus, human metapneumovirus, these are all viruses that can cause people to be hospitalized and die. But you're right. There's this kind of notion of COVID exceptionalism. If I don't have COVID, then I'm okay. But I think
it's all good.
I think we should treat them all the same way, which is, I think if you have a respiratory infection, meaning congestion, cough, runny nose, sneezing, body aches, and you're in a high-risk group, a group that is at high risk for being hospitalized, you should test yourself, and if you're positive, treat yourself with an antiviral. If you're not in a high-risk group, I don't think you do need to test yourself. You should just assume you're infected with one of these other viruses that might be COVID, and just stay home when you're sick if you can. And, you know, not all companies are great about sick leave policy, so if you can't stay home, at least wear a mask when you're outside. Don't, you know, out among other people.
Out from home, yes. Mm-hmm. It's interesting because I see sometimes people in airports or people outside walking down the street, people in their cars wearing a mask. And maybe it's just it's on. So if I go in and out, I don't have to think about it. But I don't know that it's going to help them if they wear it inside their car when they're by themselves.
Yeah, I agree with
that. Life is a balance, right? But you told me an interesting story about you're waiting in an airport and there's a fella who was on the staff who was cleaning up and sweeping. Tell us about that.
Right. So I was in Naples Airport, Naples, Florida, and flying back to Philadelphia. And there was a airport worker who was sort of sweeping along the aisles. And all of us are waiting to get on the plane. And he clearly had a bad cold. I mean, it was congestion. He was coughing. He was sneezing. His nose was dripping. He was wiping his nose on his sleeve. And he's walking among the people who were sitting there. And it's Naples, Florida, so it's an older crowd. And you can see people's facial expressions becoming sort of much more horrified as the person got closer. And finally, the woman actually had the bravery to ask or guts to ask, did you test yourself? And he proudly said, yes, I'm COVID negative. So he's not masked. But, you know, let's assume he had one of these other viral infections, respiratory syncytial virus, influenza, paraflu, et cetera, all of which cause hospitalization, all of which can cause death. And we have this COVID exception. So let's assume that he just couldn't stay home. Let's assume that the airport didn't allow him to stay home. At least wear a mask,
yeah,
because then you decrease the chance of infecting other people.
Exactly. So let's talk about long COVID. Are there drugs available that make it like less likely to develop long COVID, or is it just the luck of the draw?
So I think long COVID is more than one thing. I think there's a variety of different sort of pathogenic mechanisms that can lead to long COVID, and it's not unique to COVID. I mean, there's so-called long flu, people who have longer term symptoms associated with influenza. I would say that, you know, your best bet to avoid long COVID is to be vaccinated. I mean, there was a study done in Italy that looked at this question. And again, it's variously defined, but in their definition, people who had COVID, in their definition, that went on to have long COVID was about 42% of people. And then they looked at people who'd gotten one dose of vaccine and then got COVID. And that 42% incidence dropped to 30%. Then they looked at people who had two doses of vaccine and then got COVID. And that 30% incidence dropped to 17%. Then they looked at people who'd gotten three doses of vaccine and then got COVID, and the 17% incidence went to 16%. So not much different. There are some studies showing that there is an advantage, clearly an advantage to the third dose. But I think once you get beyond that, once you're talking about a fourth dose or fifth dose, and you've been naturally infected, I think the possibility of avoiding long COVID becomes diminishingly smaller.
And we're going to see long-term effects, like maybe some interstitial lung disease, but you can see that with pneumonia, you can see that with flu, you can see that with other conditions. But as you say, it's more than just lung residual.
Yeah, no, this is a virus that can infect the lining of blood vessels. So it can be associated with strokes, can be associated with heart attacks. So I think that was what made this virus particularly heinous.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if there are many people that have a residual GI effect. I don't see that so much. I don't hear about that so much.
Yeah, you would probably know that better than me. Yeah. I haven't seen that so much in children anyway.
So pregnant women, are they more prone to develop long COVID?
Not to my knowledge. They certainly are at greater risk because they have sort of a high blood volume associated with having the pregnancy, that their lungs are a little wetter, if you will. So therefore, they're more at risk of more serious disease associated with respiratory viruses, including COVID.
So we revisit the topic of how people evaluate their or make a decision to go forward with vaccines. I can almost say I was biting my own fingernails initially thinking, oh, this is a new technology, messenger RNA, different from anything. I mean, if it took you 27 years to develop the rotavirus, I wish we had maybe 27 months. It was a technology that worked and it ended up having great results. But you can see why people might hesitate a little bit with the COVID vaccine. But why now? Has it melted into distrust of time-tested vaccinations like the flu vaccine? From what I understand, children going into kindergarten, there's a statistic now, tell us about that, that many fewer children, parents are deciding not to get any vaccines. That's why we had that bump in measles before, like a year ago or so. Tell us about that, if you would.
Well, so the group most likely to be hospitalized now with COVID are people over 75, because they are less capable of making a good immune response, because they're more likely to have chronic diseases that put them at high risk. The second group most likely to be hospitalized are those between sort of 60 and 74 years of age who have high-risk medical conditions. But the third group most likely to be hospitalized are children less than 5 years of age.
Wow.
And the reason is they're unvaccinated. I mean, the vaccination rate in that age group is only about 4 or 5%. And this virus is going to be with us for decades, if not longer. I mean, there are four strains of human coronavirus that circulate in this country. Four. One of them entered and all were animal to human spillover events, just like this virus. One of them entered the human population in the late 1700s. Another one entered the human population in the late 1800s. Let's assume this virus is going to be with us for a long time. So make sure that you've been sort of fully vaccinated. And if you're a healthy young person, at least as it stands, you don't necessarily need a yearly vaccine. But if you're in the high-risk group, you should get a yearly vaccine.
Mm-hmm. But when you hear people that are concerned about vaccines, not vaccinating their children with MMR, which is measles, mumps, rubella,
And we just did a show last week on people with visual impairments and blindness. And in the 1950s, I went to a very large grade school with 2,500 students. 2,500. And right next to us was St. Lucie Day School for the Blind. And most of those children were blind because they were born prematurely for whatever reason, often from rubella. I mean, you know this from your... And rubella in the mom can lead to premature birth, and those babies, if they got too much oxygen, retinal damage, blindness. Now it's a different playbook, but why would we let rubella get back out of control? Please, listeners, get your children vaccinated with the time-tested MMR pertussis. Tell us about pertussis. We're seeing a jump in that as well, yeah?
Yeah, no, so before there was a pertussis vaccine, and the first pertussis vaccine was in 1947, there were 8,000 children who would die every year of pertussis or whooping cough. Now, you know, that number has dramatically declined, but there has been an increase in pertussis cases over the last year, really about a threefold increase. And in large part, it's because a greater and greater number of parents are choosing not to vaccinate their kindergarten. So not only is pertussis increased, but measles has increased, and influenza. There were about more than 200 children that died of influenza last year, almost all of whom were unvaccinated, and half of whom were perfectly healthy. So these are preventable illnesses, and there's so much in medicine we don't know. There's so much we can't do. This we know, and it's hard to watch people make these choices to put their children at
risk. So this is really the, I wouldn't say the best time, but this is the time of year that's really October. Get your flu shot now because it protects you well into maybe March. And rarely you'll see a second strain come along of the flu, maybe March, April-ish, and rarely a person can get a second go around with the flu. But for the most part, October is a good time. But you can get it as late as what, November, December?
Mm-hmm. You're better. Yeah, this is September, October.
So I guess another question is, I was talking to a patient the other day who went and had the COVID vaccine, the current COVID vaccine, with the flu vaccine. I was like, ooh, how are we with that? Is that a good idea, or is it better to separate?
No, that's what I did. I got both.
Oh, did you?
COVID and flu vaccine recently. See?
Okay.
I'm still talking, so that's a good sign.
There you go. Okay, you didn't turn into a zombie. So RSV, where are we with the RSV vaccine?
Right. So there's an RSV vaccine for adults that's recommended for everybody over 75 and for those between 60 and 74 who have high-risk medical conditions. There's also an RSV vaccine for pregnant people that should be given between 32 and 36 weeks gestation between sort of September and January. And there's a monoclonal antibody, which is something where you basically give the child antibodies. This is a monoclonal antibody directed against just one site on RSV that can be given also before the RSV season. And RSV, like flu, is somewhat easier because those are both winter viruses,
yeah,
whereas COVID is still a year-round virus.
Mm. So again, RSV vaccination for patients, people 75 and over, 60 to 74 if you're at high risk because you have heart or lung disease, kidney disease, and for pregnant women between weeks 32 and 36 if they're going to deliver between September and January. That makes sense. And people can reference this. Maybe we'll put some of these points of information on our website so people can reference them. The other thing about the RSV, so RSV, flu shot, and COVID, it doesn't hurt if you decide to mix two or just COVID and flu.
No, you can get these at the same time.
Wow, good to know. I know what I had in my head, that for people that are expecting their first grandchild, or if time has passed and their grandparents should be vaccinated. Briefly, what do we tell grandparents who are expecting a new baby in their world?
Right. Well, so you should be up to date on the vaccines that are recommended for you. Obviously, if you have any symptoms consistent with the respiratory infection, just stay away. I think stay away until you really feel better.
But the big one that people might not think about is Tdap, right? You want to get that updated so that you don't carry pertussis. How likely is that? But it's possible. So Tdap is the one that we tell grandparents awaiting a new baby,
sure.
Yes. Beautiful.
Yep, sure.
All right, let's take one last break and we'll be back with our wrap up with Dr. Paul Offit from Children's Hospital of Philadelphia.
Your Radio Doctor with Dr. Marianne Ritchie is presented exclusively by Independence Blue Cross.
At Independence Blue Cross, we take care of the people who take care of you.
everyday heroes like firefighters, police officers, teachers, farmers, and healthcare workers. Doctors and hospitals across the region have IBX, and they know what it means to have reliable access to care. So whether you're saving lives or just trying to live a healthier life, count on IBX, the region's number one health insurer for 85 years. Learn more at IBX.com.
Welcome back to our final segment of Your Radio Doctor. I always call the wrap-up your weekly prescription because we have learned so much, as we always do, from the eloquent and learned Dr. Paul Offit. And Paul, I think what I'm learning from my reading and talking to you is some of the hesitation people had with the COVID vaccine when it came out, even though it was gene sequenced and the technology was beautiful. People were thinking, messenger RNA, do I want little fragments of RNA floating in me? But it's proven to be safe, certainly effective. But the current vaccine, the 2024/2025 season vaccine, is no longer messenger RNA technology. It's the good old-fashioned way of designing a vaccine. Let's talk about that for a minute, because I think that would allay the fear of a lot of people sitting on the fence.
Well, so still, the Pfizer-Moderna vaccine this year, which is based on the so-called KP2 strain, that's messenger RNA. So both those vaccines are still messenger RNA. Novavax also has a vaccine, which is a purified protein vaccine, made much the same way that we make the hepatitis B vaccine or the human papillomavirus vaccine. So there's, you know, there's 30-plus years of experience with something like the hepatitis B vaccine. So some people are a little more comfortable with a more well-worn technology. But I would say that this vaccine, the mRNA vaccines, now have been really well studied in terms of you know, the fact that billions of people have received it at this point, and we pay a lot of attention to this vaccine. And also, when people call it new, certainly it's the first time we've ever used messenger RNA technology to ever make a vaccine, ever. So it was remarkable that we were able to make this vaccine safely and effectively in 11 months, which was the fastest vaccine ever made. So I get the skepticism that people would have, because the previous fastest vaccine ever made was the mumps vaccine back in the 60s, which was 4 years. And that was much lower sort of bar that they had to meet, you know, back in the 60s than we have to meet now. So I understand that. But and also remember that although the technology is new in terms of a vaccine, people have been working on mRNA as a possible vaccine since like the 1997, which is when Drew Weissman met Katie Carrico at their Xerox machine there at the University of Pennsylvania, formed a collaboration, and ultimately won the Nobel Prize this year in medicine for that collaboration. So it's been working at it for a while. It's not that new.
Well, I would love for people to consider this a must read, as I do. This is your book that came out in the spring called Tell Me When It's Over. Sounds like words from a Temptation song. Wake me when it's over. Tell Me When It's Over by Paul Offit. Give us a little summary, because I think people would, I think if they had a look back, it's always helpful to look at the past and consider the present before you decide how you're going to handle the future, or you're going to give us a learned guesstimate what the future will hold.
Yeah, I think there were things that we got right and things that we got wrong during this pandemic. And I go through all of them. I guess as a voting member of the FDA Vaccine Advisory Committee, I had to some extent a front row seat to watch those things that we got right and things that we got wrong. And I hope that, you know, those who don't learn from history are condemned to repeat it, as is said by George Santayana. And so I think that's true here, too. So that's what I wanted to go through. In many ways, it's like a mea culpa, because I think we all were did and said some things that ended up not being true. And I think to some extent we did lose some faith in the public about sort of the public health agencies. And so it's that trying to talk about what we got right and what we got wrong. We got a lot right. We certainly, these vaccines were estimated to save about 3 million lives. But on the other hand, there were people who didn't trust us that chose not to get a vaccine, and about 230,000 people in the United States lost their lives because they chose not to get a vaccine because they didn't trust us. So how can we, again, sort of rekindle that trust and make sure that we're transparent about everything that we do?
Well, I think the difference now between, say, comparing a vaccination designed during COVID versus mumps or polio or any of those other times, we are so much more mobile now. I mean, our kids study around the world when they're in college. And so bugs from other continents are being mixed together, and then you're dealing with social media, people give an opinion about their symptoms that might not be nuanced, and that it puts people in yes or no immediately, and it's not verified. I mean, they're the mountains that you had to climb this time, yes?
Right. Also, thousands of people were dying a day. I mean, you know, this we were building this plane while it was in the air at some level. So, of course, we learned as we went. I think if you ask people, do you think we're going to know more about science and medicine 20 years from now than we know now? I think everybody would say yes. But when it comes to, you know, your disease, or in this case, our pandemic, people want to believe that you know everything. And you don't know everything.
No.
When you make that decision, when we made the decision to move forward for recommending this vaccine, our committee did, in December of 2020, it's not like we thought we knew everything. We just thought we knew enough. And
yes.
So decisions were made.
Well, see, that's what people should, that's what I admire about you, Paul. The last time we had you on the show, you had talked about, okay, if you don't have any big risk factors, and if you've gotten the two initial doses of the vaccine and then a booster, then every time you get a booster, it's just boosting the backflow of soldiers, the antibodies. Your T cells, the type of white cell that has a different job, is much stronger. That's protecting you. But now, with a new generation of COVID, this vaccine, we're going to call it a vaccine now. It's not a booster any longer. It's a vaccine. It has a different role. It's going to behave a little differently. Is that a good way to say it?
Yeah, so Novavax is a vaccine that is available, should be more readily available now that it's been picked up by Sanofi, Pasteur. So, and hopefully we'll generate more data on this vaccine.
Mm-hmm. Both work. But I'm making the point that you and your opinion and your suggestions change with time, because life is dynamic. And other people who might have been standing still with an opinion, you said, hey, this is what we thought in 2020, and now it's 2023, and this is how I look at it now. And I admire you for that, because being a really good doctor means that you're humble. And you can admit, hey, we didn't know then what we know now, right?
Right.
All summarized in your book, again, from my friends, Tell Me When It's Over by Dr. Paul Offit. Great read. It will really help you make your decisions. And we thank you so much, Paul. As always, you're such a great help and a great teacher.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Thanks for listening to your Radio Doctor every Saturday afternoon at 5 here on Talk Radio 1210 WPHT. Listen to any of our shows again on audacy.com. That's AUDACY.com. A special thank you to our exclusive sponsor, Independent Blue Cross, for their continued support and faith in my content. Join our Diapers for Darlings campaign. Help a needy mother. Donate a bag of disposable diapers. Website? www.yougivegoods.com. We'll be collecting from now through December. And please remember to pray for peace in our world, our beloved country, in our families, and in each of our own hearts. This is your Radio Doctor, Dr. Marianne Ritchie, wishing you a happy, healthy, and safe week with the ones you love. Always here to remind you that your health is your wealth.
Thanks for listening to your Radio Doctor, Dr. Marianne Ritchie, presented exclusively by Independence Blue Cross. To contact Dr. Marianne and to listen to today's show as well as past shows, visit yourradiodoctor.com. This program is paid for by Your Radio Doctor, LLC. All opinions or statements expressed on this program are solely those of Your Radio Doctor and their guests and do not reflect the opinions of WPHT or Odyssey. Today's program has been pre-recorded.
At Independence Blue Cross, we take care of the people who take care of you. Everyday heroes like firefighters, police officers, teachers, farmers, and healthcare workers. Doctors and hospitals across the region have IBX, and they know what it means to have reliable access to care. So whether you're saving lives or just trying to live a healthier life, count on IBX, the region's number one health insurer for 85 years. Learn more at IBX.com.